In October 2017, the Worcester Regional Research Bureau released a new report, Foreclosure in the City of Worcester.
This report came about because Worcester, like the nation, struggled with the issue of foreclosures for a number of years.
That's Research Bureau Executive Director Tim McGurthy.
Beginning around 2008, foreclosures grew as the Great Recession grew, and in Worcester we felt that impact. And the challenge became, what should municipal government do to address foreclosures? And the Worcester Regional Research Bureau, we are a nonprofit focused on putting forth informed municipal public policy. So we decided to look into the issue and write a report.
McGurthy explains how foreclosure happens in Massachusetts.
When someone takes out a mortgage or borrows money to purchase a home, they then become obligated to repay that mortgage over a period of time. If, as a result of job loss or medical condition or something, that person is unable to pay the monthly cost of maintaining that mortgage, at some point, the bank will notify the owner that they are in arrears. And if that arrearage is not addressed, the bank will initiate foreclosure proceedings. In Massachusetts, we are a non-judicial state, which means you grant the bank the right to sell your home under the terms of the mortgage, if for lack of repayment.
The report shows that the number of petitions to foreclose in Worcester began to grow in 2014. They increased by 80% in 2015 and saw a 17% increase in 2016.
Those in the field were telling us these are not new homes coming under foreclosure. These are homes that have been on a foreclosure list for many years that are finally moving forward.
And what has the response to this report been?
Quiet. We were a little surprised that it was not really picked up or addressed by anyone.
I'm Hallie Blashfield.
I'm Beatrice Mischer, and you're listening to Foreclosures for Sale, revisiting stories of Worcester's mortgage crisis. One group that has not been quiet about the issue of foreclosure is the Worcester Anti-Foreclosure Team, or WAFT for short. WAFT is a mutual aid organization founded in 2008. Their mission is to educate community members about their rights when it comes to the foreclosure process. WAFT has received attention and criticism locally. They take an aggressive stance against what they say are legal tactics used by large banks and their lawyers in foreclosure cases.
On Saturday, February 3rd, Beatrice and I arrive at WAFT's headquarters. We're here to meet Outreach Coordinator Chris Horton. Every weekend, Chris leads other volunteers in knocking on the doors of houses that have been foreclosed and scheduled for auction to try and connect with homeowners and tenants. It's 20 degrees outside when we get to the office, and Chris is late. A nearby couple say they're WAFT members and invite us to wait in their car, where we get to talking about their foreclosure.
Are you still fighting your foreclosure?
Yes, I am. Yeah. Yes, and we're getting results. Without them, I don't know where I would be, to tell you the honest truth. You call them, they'll answer. They're with you step by step, through the courts, through your paperwork and stuff.
That's Miranda Suda, a certified nursing assistant. Miranda came to the U.S. from Dominica, a small Caribbean country, in 1986. She met her husband, Kerry Suda, a soft-spoken airman for the U.S. military, in 2014, and the couple soon started dating.
I was at a friend's house, and Kerry was walking down the street. And you want to finish up the story?
Yeah, they were at a party. We were having outside. Just kind of walked by.
And they crashed the party. Let's just put it that way. They invited them, and, you know, we were introduced, and Kerry just sat there and kept looking at me and looking at me. And then the next day, he texted me and said he had a wonderful time. I'm like, okay. We just kept texting. And then I said, why don't you just call me? You know, instead of texting all the time. And he called, and I had to put the volume up so high because he was talking so soft. I couldn't hear a thing. I was like, yeah, 15 minutes we spoke, and then the rest is history.
Miranda had purchased her Worcester home in 2006, But in 2013, she broke her leg and had to stop working for over a year. As her income slowed, she defaulted on payments, and after trying for months to modify her payment agreement, the bank initiated foreclosure proceedings.
I've been fighting with them, not really fight, but trying to work with them to get like a payment plan and get everything back together. They call it like a loan modification. And every month it was always something. Either the paper wasn't right or it's outdated. I have to start all over again. And I have like about 50 files with the same stupid questions, you know, the packets, they'll send you this big packet and you fill it out and you send it out and they'll send it back. Well, you're missing this document. You send out the document. We didn't find it. We need you to send it out again.
Carrie Suda.
After a year, after we started dating and trying to do the loan modification paperwork, and it just kept going in circles for like another year and a half. And they were going to foreclose in June of 17, and then in October, that's when they went through and we all protested it.
Miranda was devastated about the foreclosure.
I was so sad. I was like, oh God, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Where do I go from there? Sometimes you don't have enough finance to get you from point A to B.
While the bank was initiating the foreclosure, Carrie was deployed in Iraq. A federal law established in 1940 called the Service Members Civil Relief Act protects active duty military service members from foreclosure and other judgments while deployed. At first, Miranda didn't realize the law's relevance to their situation and didn't disclose Carrie's status. But even once Carrie returned and notified the bank, they continued with the foreclosure. Now Miranda and Carrie are involved in ongoing efforts to fight the foreclosure and regain ownership of their home. They got involved with WAFT when outreach coordinator Chris Horton knocked on their door one day.
That day I was going to work and I saw Chris and another lady. And he said, can I talk to you? And I was like, okay. But I was kind of, you know, leery. And then he said, we saw that your house has been foreclosed on, but we just want you to know that you can stay in your house. And I was like, are you sure? And he said, yes. And he continued explaining to me and telling me. So he won my interest and my trust. And I went to the meeting. And it's like as if a weight was lifted off my shoulders. Seriously, a weight. I don't know about tomorrow, but for now, I'm confident.
On this Saturday, Miranda is hoping to bring this same kind of relief to other struggling homeowners. If no one comes to the door, members of WAFT leave them a pamphlet of information.
Some people will knock on the door and you can see them looking for the window. And as soon as we leave, they'll grab the paper. So I'm hoping, Chris says, if you touch one person, you've done a good job. So I'm hoping today we do something.
Once Chris arrives, Beatrice and I split up. I go along with Chris and she accompanies Miranda and Carrie.
As we get in the car, Miranda and Carrie show me a map with the locations of houses with upcoming auctions. Each week, Chris painstakingly compiles these Worcester County addresses from online databases like masspublicnotices.org and local newspapers. This will be our guide for the day, and so we set off with a classic rock station playing in the background. The first two houses we stop at have already been vacated by the owners. Miranda is discouraged.
And can you imagine driving all day? You know, sometimes we start at 2. And we go all day until 5 and haven't touched anybody. It's very depressing.
At the third house we pull up to, there are papers tacked on the front door and scattered around the yard.
It's so sad. It's all boarded up. The constables put these papers on top of it.
The director of community initiatives at the Maine South Community Development Corporation, Casey Starr, told us how foreclosures impact not only individuals, but also entire communities.
In the context of properties within our neighborhood that have gone through foreclosure and are now bank-owned properties, you know, you're left with a property that doesn't have people living in it. It's like a property that doesn't have people living in it is always at risk of being violated.
Yvette Dyson, the executive director of Worcester Common Ground Community Development Corporation, agrees.
So foreclosure in general devastates a neighborhood. You don't want to see that happen to the buildings, and then there's squatters in there and it becomes a safety issue and the building's deteriorating.
Again, Casey Starr.
We've had a really difficult time getting banks to actively manage the properties that they own. So that means simple things like trash on the property and windows being blown out. The snow removal is a huge issue.
After 5 unsuccessful stops, we finally find someone who is still in their home, just as the sun is setting.
Hi.
A man in his 30s answers the door, holding a baby with other children behind him. He seems suspicious at first. Miranda and Carrie explain how they were also foreclosed on and are still living in their house. The man says adamantly that his house is being illegally foreclosed on and that he is prepared to fight to keep his home. Miranda and Carrie invite him to the next WAFT meeting. Back in the car, Miranda celebrates the fact that they finally reached someone.
It was worth it, let me tell you. And the idea that he wants to fight for his house.
As we start driving back to the WAFT headquarters, Miranda asks if I've heard from Hallie and Chris.
When I texted her last, she said they had just gotten to their first house.
Oh, wow. It's going to be a long night for her.
Yeah.
By the time Miranda and Carrie are finishing their list, Chris is just getting started. Chris Horton is WAFT's volunteer outreach coordinator. 10 years ago, he was retiring from teaching as the economic crisis accelerated. Driven by a passion for justice, he joined WAFT. The 73-year-old now goes door knocking most weekends. At the first two houses we visit, no one is home. But at the third address, a modest single-family home in Shrewsbury, there are still Christmas decorations up. As we walk up to the front door, we can see that lights are on inside. Chris knocks. A woman answers her door with a toddler on her hip. Several other children play in the room behind her. As Chris explains why he's there, she takes his information and writes down the upcoming auction date. She is a tenant and clearly has no idea that the house has even been foreclosed on. After her husband appears and she explains the situation to him in Portuguese, Chris tells her he might be able to arrange for a Portuguese translator to be at the meeting. She says they'll come if they can get a babysitter.
I'm not convinced that she's going to come to our meeting, but we'll follow up with a phone call.
Is it common that you were the first person to tell her about the foreclosure?
Yes, very common. We get to a place after the foreclosure, it's very common for the tenants not to know it's even been foreclosed. Sometimes they're completely outraged. How can you do that to me? We've been friends for 30 years. But landlords are terrified that if the tenant finds out, they'll just stop paying rent. And that could be the final blow for their effort to hold on to the building.
State and federal law protects tenants in foreclosed buildings from being evicted before the end of their lease. However, there is no legal requirement that tenants be notified about a foreclosure. If their landlord doesn't inform them, the only way they would know is if they happen to read the auction notice in the newspaper. At the final address, Chris rolls down his window and directs a flashlight at the house to read the number. Soon, a young man approaches and stands aggressively over the driver's side of the car, questioning us about our presence. Chris gives him a WAFT brochure, but the man seems distrustful. He tells us it's his family house and we need to leave. As we pull over a few blocks away to meet Beatrice, I ask Chris about the interaction.
I'm curious how often that kind of thing happens.
He comes out here.
Or he seemed a little suspicious of you.
That is very normal. If fraudulent loan modification specialists coming offering to save their home for $5,000, they have lawyers coming offering to a bankruptcy to save their home for $3,000. You have real estate agents coming around trying to talk them into a short sale. Bank agents coming around trying to get a look at their property. And they don't know what's going to happen next and they're scared.
How does it feel to be trying to get these resources to them when they're feeling so suspicious of you?
Can't let it get to me. I just have to be relentless. Because I know what's on the other side. A huge relief and gratitude if they reach the point of choosing to trust us. Because basically they're alone now. There is nobody that's really on their side and they don't know what's going to happen next. And they're frustrated and angry. And very often by the time it comes to the foreclosure, they reach the point where they're just exhausted with being angry. You can't stay angry forever. It will tear your body down. It will tear apart your mind and your body and ruin your health. We're showing up right around that time. And so it takes some persistence to break through. And sometimes we're too late. Sometimes people have already given up and there's nothing to be done about it. And they know that their home is being robbed and they know what the bank is doing is illegal and criminal. But they've already reached the point of exhaustion and resignation. Just waiting outside the court chambers, I've had three people collapse with me. Two of them literally collapsed into my arms. One had a stroke, one had a severe blood pressure excursion. Neither of them recovered. Grace can quote statistics for you, and I believe they're true, that the only life event that compares to foreclosure is the death of a child, in terms of how it impacts people.
A 2008 study done through Iowa State University found that foreclosure on a mortgage ranks just below familial death and disabling injury as a stressor.
So I'm not going to judge people for pushing me away. I've had one person threaten to get his shotgun, told me to leave, and I dropped off a flyer and left, and he called me the next day. So some you can't win, but you can't give up.
The stigma surrounding foreclosures can make it hard for people to talk to neighbors, friends, and family members about what they are going through. WAFT member Micheline Oliveira immigrated to the U.S. from Brazil with her husband in 2000. They bought their Worcester home in 2006. She recalls how her foreclosure made her feel.
I felt shame of myself. I didn't have the courage to talk with a neighbor or family or friend about my situation. Because it's always my fault. I couldn't afford, you know. Until I realized it was more than just pay a mortgage.
At one of WAFT's Wednesday night meetings, it's possible to forget, only for a moment, that everyone in the room is facing a possibility of losing their home. Members greet each other with hugs, jokes, and life updates. Some people have been members of the organization for years. Each meeting begins with their Bill of Rights for homeowners and renters facing foreclosure, which they read aloud as a group. The ritual is a reminder for returning members, as well as an introduction to new members. The first thing they go over in the meeting is a letter called the Notice to Quit. WAFT organizer Lori Cairns explains how the notice works.
How many people have gotten their 72-hour notice? All right, yeah, so it is a scary letter. It's a very legal letter, and it makes you feel like you need to be out last week and everything you own, but don't panic. Call us. Call us right away. Nothing's going to happen. You know, you don't get a letter in the mail and be evicted the next day. You have to go to court, and only the judge could evict you. And that's not even overnight either.
Many homeowners vacate their houses upon receiving their notice to quit. The foreclosure process is confusing, and navigating it alone without legal representation can be daunting. WAFT is a mutual aid organization, which means that members exchange resources and knowledge they've gained from their own foreclosure experience.
So my name's Grace, and I live here in Worcester, and I was a tenant in a foreclosed building in 2007.
That's WAFT founder Grace Ross. She is also a lobbyist for the Massachusetts Alliance Against Predatory Lending and has been active in grassroots organizing for many years.
The reason that we have these meetings is because you're not alone in getting run over by a bank, but everybody's been fighting alone. I often use the image of the gazelle. The lions get the gazelle that gets separated off. So it's really, really important to hang together. We don't want the lions to keep picking you off. And that's why we meet together, so that you learn from each other, you can rely on each other, you get to know each other's situations and what people are doing that's succeeding.
Only organizer Lori Cairns is paid for her work. The rest of WAFT's members volunteer to assist each other.
It's about paying it forward to the next person. You know, say you're housebound, but you've got a phone and you're really good at listening to people when they're upset. A lot of people get upset, understandably, and having a good ear to listen can be the thing that makes a difference between somebody giving up or not.
Lori Cairns.
If you have administrative skills, you may be good on explaining to other people what they're going through, the court process. Or you may be good with paperwork, you know, legal work, whatever. But we need everybody to engage until we get strong.
A big part of the mutual aid of WAFT is that people support other members at stressful events like a housing auction or court date. They provide this help despite having full-time jobs, children, and impending foreclosures of their own.
So we're going to keep fighting this, but you want us to come do a protest and make sure they don't do more illegal things at the auction?
Absolutely.
Okay, so we're going to stand by Milad?
Yes! Yes!
WAFT recently added a second weekly meeting to help people prepare their own legal documents and practice for upcoming court appearances.
Of the auctions, of the people who've been coming to Monday night workshops and finding out how to postpone an auction, I think we're running at about a 75% success rate on postponing or getting auctions canceled.
Damaris Kachunga hopes to be one of those successful stories. She came to WAFT's headquarters on a frigid February night to prepare for her auction protest the following morning.
And so your auction is tomorrow?
Yeah, 10 o'clock.
How are you feeling?
Very nervous because I've been in the property since 2005.
Worcester Research Bureau's Tim McGurthy explains foreclosure auctions.
So the bank is not the owner until the auction. What the mortgage does is it grants the bank a right to sell the home, but not to take ownership of the home. So on the auction day, the bank will be present at the home. They will have an auctioneer that will offer the home for sale to whoever is there, standing at the house ready to purchase. If the highest bid comes in at, say, $10,000, and the house is worth well more than $10,000, and the mortgage is worth more than $10,000, the bank can choose to purchase it itself.
That's how auctions are supposed to happen. The morning of Kachunga's auction, WAFT members are present to make sure the bank-hired auctioneer follows the appropriate protocols. Kachunga stands nearby as WAFT member Liz DeDoming points out the auctioneer as he arrives.
Well, I think that might be the auctioneer. What he does, he'll stand like here or something, and she says she opposes him coming on the property. That's why they put caution tape up. And like the people who are possible investors, they're not supposed to come on the property. And she says to them that she's going to fight it the whole time. And
as he gets out of the car, the protesters become more alert.
Get any video of anything that happened to you?
Yep.
No problem. You need to get a good picture.
Yep.
WAFT records video of every foreclosure auction they attend in case the auctioneer or a representative of the bank does something they believe is illegal. Several WAFT members say that bank witnesses who claim to have been present at their auction were not. Some even allege that their auction never physically took place, but that a falsified change of ownership was still filed in the Registry of Deeds. In Massachusetts, a foreclosing party must possess both the mortgage and the promissory note in order to legally foreclose. We asked former federal litigator Sarah McKee to explain the two documents.
There are actually two parts of a mortgage loan. One of them is the promissory note in which you promise to pay the lender whatever the amount of the loan is under whatever terms there are in the note. And the mortgage secures the repayment of the note.
McKee has over 40 years of legal experience. She litigated for the U.S. Department of Energy, and in 2013, she was Governor Deval Patrick's appointee for law to the Massachusetts Legislature's Registry of Deeds Commission. It was here she became concerned about banks cutting corners. She told us the common practice of electronically transferring mortgages between banks means that sometimes ownership can get confused.
Starting in the mid-80s, the Federal Tax Reform Act of 1986, banks got legal authority to take your mortgage and your note and bundle them up with a couple other thousand of them and sell the resulting stream of income from all of those mortgages to large investors, pension funds.
This process is known as securitization. In order to make the buying and selling of mortgage-backed security trusts easier, in 1997, banks began using the Mortgage Electronic Registration System, or MERS. MERS replaced the public documentation of physical mortgage transfers with a privatized electronic system. It eliminated the need to transfer the physical documents. One result is that mortgages and their corresponding notes sometimes get separated or lost when lenders sell these securities and fail to properly document the chain of transfers. Banks often cannot show evidence that they possess both the mortgage and the note, which provides a common argument against the validity of a foreclosure. We asked Sarah McKee why what seems like a technicality matters.
Well, one way it impacts is that you can be supposedly foreclosed by someone who does not own your mortgage. And the person who owns your mortgage is theoretically out there somewhere and can come in and want to be paid. I know one homeowner who he's been foreclosed, same mortgage, by two different large banks. And there is also a third financial institution that claims to own the mortgage.
Back at Gachunga's auction, the auctioneer requests to see a letter she claims she sent to the foreclosing party, Bank of America. The letter is a demand that Bank of America provide evidence that they hold not just her mortgage, but also the note, which would give them legal authority to foreclose.
And do you have that letter that
they don't
responding?
Have it? They got it. Why are they not providing you with one? Because I sent it to them and they received it. I sent it with a registered mail.
Yeah.
And the following day they got it.
So, I'm not talking to the bank. So I'm
who
talking
are you
to
talking
the law
to?
Firm. So...
Then they should get it from there.
They're trying.
Yeah, they need to get it from there. I'm not providing them because I sent them a document.
That's up to you, okay.
No, I have it. But why don't they provide? And they're working for them.
I can't answer that.
Gachunga is frustrated because the bank's legal team is asking her to provide proof of the very documents they are having trouble obtaining from their own client. If this seems confusing, this might give you an idea of the difficulties homeowners say they have communicating with their mortgage holders.
Then why are you asking me? Ask the bank. Then get back to
you
me.
You know what it's like talking to the bank, getting answers from the bank?
Yes. That is
That's
how
why I'm
it is,
you.
Trying to get my house.
If you didn't catch that, the auctioneer admits to Gachunga that it's virtually impossible to communicate with the bank. She already knows this. The protesters wait in an awkward standoff with the auctioneer. At about 10:40, he approaches again, this time to begin the auction.
But all the bidders left, so there'll be no third-party sale.
Get the cameras rolling. So you do not have a right to step on this property? Your entry in this property is opposed. Do you want to tell them that?
Yeah, you have no right to enter in my property.
Okay.
Yes.
Please get off the property.
Come this way, please.
Please get off this property. You are entering opposed, and it is illegal.
Notice more do you sell the
no,
step
come
off
this
the
way.
Property
we
now.
Cannot reason what you are saying. You need to be out of my property. It's illegal. No. You need to get out of my property. You have no right. You have no right. You have no right to do that. So get out of the property. So why are you breaking the law? And you want us to obey the law? Why are you breaking the law? You have no right to do that.
If you claim this is an unopposed entry, you will be perjuring yourself.
Yes.
You'll be lying.
That's a lie. You are in my property and it's illegal.
The auctioneer continues to read as WAFT members tell him to leave the property. An old Massachusetts general law, known as foreclosure by entry and possession, says that foreclosure may be carried out by a peaceable and unopposed entry onto the property in question. This is why the protesters use such specific language. If the auction is documented as a peaceable possession by entry, they will try to submit video evidence as proof that the entry was opposed.
June 28, 1985, recorded the Worcester District
Registry
of Book 877, page 392, two order of the conditions of Worcester Conservation. Commission has recorded Book 8523, page 74, dated November 21st, 1984, three easements for sewer and water lines.
In Craft Circle, the city of Worcester,
37, don't
evict. Conveyed to Damaris W. Kachunga, individually by deed from Robert L. Ruiz and back. Ruth Ruiz, husband and wife, is sentenced by the entirety recorded 172.5 and deed book 35,472, page 309, 3. Plan for Worcester County, Massachusetts, and the Robert team in the Worcester publication.
Since there aren't any third party buyers, the bank will purchase the property itself.
Bank enters a bid of $187,228.10. That's going once, twice, sold to the bank.
In about 5 minutes, Gachunga's house has been sold back to the bank. When paperwork is submitted to legitimize the auction, it will be documented as a peaceable possession by entry. You may have noticed that you heard no bidding at this auction. That's because the auctioneer was both facilitating the sale and bidding on behalf of the purchasing bank.
We were confused about how that works and what the auction looked like from an auctioneer's perspective. So we sat down with Frank Trapasso. Trapasso's business handles civil processes in Worcester, such as evictions and foreclosure auctions.
I'll have to say, like, the banks I work for, there's always a representative there of the bank. The attorney for the bank is there, and myself. So there's always people present. I've been to other auctions where, and I don't know how this happens, where the auctioneer is the bank, the auctioneer is the agent, and he's the auctioneer. And personally, I think there's some flaw in that part of the system.
Why?
Well, they give the auctioneer power of attorney because the attorney can't be there for the bank. But my argument there is, hey, these banks are big enough and they have many employees. You send a representative from the bank to be there. By having a power of attorney, it's legal. But I think it takes away from any type of transparency or information that you might be looking for because the auctioneer doesn't know. He does not know. And he doesn't have the legal wherewithal to answer a legal question either.
Trapasso told us that this sort of auctioneer behavior happens most often with large multinational banks.
Bank of America, Santander, you know, JP Morgan, like just huge banks.
As an auctioneer, Trapasso takes issue with WAFT's tactics, however.
My argument with WAFT is they don't really understand the complete scenario. They'll just pick up on one little thing and they'll run with it. I mean, they're nice people. It's just that they don't understand. It's not that black and white. You're so anxious to buy a house. You get your loan. You know what you're going to pay every month. And then unfortunately, you lost your job. But it's not the bank's fault you lost your job. It's not the bank's fault your husband left you. They just assume that all the banks are bad. Personally, they cause more havoc than it's worth.
WAFT founder Grace Ross says it's more complicated than that.
So the problem here is that there's this presumption that, well, you know, if we're out fighting for so many people, not that many people could have been illegal. Like, the percentage of the foreclosures that are illegal can't be as high as those activists seem to make it look like they are. And the real problem is they're way worse. The piece that's being missed is that this is not an individual phenomenon. It's being seen as an individual phenomenon. It's a systemic problem. So are there going to be some folks who, you know, if there wasn't a pervasive injustice, would be foreclosed on? Sure, that's always been true. There's always been a small percentage of folks who get foreclosed on, and I'm sure there are a million reasons, and some of them probably are still not legitimate. But we're not talking about that.
Through her work with the Massachusetts Alliance Against Predatory Lending, Ross has realized that the real problem is that predatory lending is profitable. Predatory loans benefit the lender and ignore the borrower's ability to repay the debt. These types of lenders impose unfair terms on a borrower, either through intentional deception or by taking advantage of a borrower's lack of understanding of the loan. Often, borrowers are drawn in by initially low monthly payments, which will later double or triple.
If you look at it as just, oh, those idiots who are getting foreclosed, you miss the entire point. We're talking about a pervasive phenomenon where from 2001 to 2007, the top 1%'s income rose 10 times faster than everyone else. It was the money from the housing bubble that fed the massive wealth increase of the very wealthiest. This isn't about whether Beatrice messed up on a mortgage payment. Right? This is the driving force for a massive wealth accumulation by a tiny percentage of the entire world population, and they made inconceivably large amounts of money by basically draining wealth out of the pockets of homeowners. And the reality is that anybody who got one of those overpriced subprime mortgages that's still paying on it is as much a victim as somebody who's foreclosed on. Anybody who pays on one of these subprime mortgages for the full 30 years will have paid six times the value of the house.
WAFT has been helping homeowner Nancy Sullivan fight her foreclosure. She was the victim of a predatory loan and even received a settlement from her lender, New Century Mortgage.
My name is Nancy Sullivan. I'm 57 years old, and I live in Charlton. That's where my home is. I built it in 1999 with my ex-husband, and I bought him out of the house in 2006 after a divorce. And at that time, the market was incredibly inflated. So I ended up having to double what we owed on the house to buy my ex-husband out. I didn't have credit in my own name, and so I was really at the mercy of who was going to give me a mortgage.
Sullivan found a mortgage company in Auburn, Massachusetts. They connected her with New Century Mortgage.
Although it sounded extremely high and my house was appraised at double, I didn't know any better. So I took what I could get so that I could buy this house out for my daughter. And little did I know that it was a predatory loan. It was a subprime loan. Literally, my mortgage went from $1,400 a month to $3,000 a month. 9 months later, I had never missed a payment, and I wanted to refinance so that I could make it more affordable.
A refinance replaces the existing mortgage with a new loan with more favorable terms. Another way that debt can be reconfigured is through a loan modification, which is an adjustment to the terms of a borrower's existing loan.
I had a really good career at the time, but this was also following an elderly parent being diagnosed with Alzheimer's, taking care of an elderly parent, taking care of a child. I went to refinance the house 9 months later, and my house lost $81,000 in equity in that short period of time, so I couldn't refinance.
Sullivan was able to stay on top of her payments until she lost her job in 2009. In 2011, Sullivan found out that because of her subprime loan, she was eligible to receive $104,000 to apply to her mortgage. It was part of a settlement then Attorney General Martha Coakley negotiated with investment bank Morgan Stanley. Coakley said that Morgan Stanley knew that New Century was making predatory loans, but continued to buy the loans and turn them into securities.
June 15, 2011, $104,000 was applied to my mortgage to bring my mortgage down and make it more affordable, but that never happened. They applied the $104,000 to the principal, but my monthly payments never decreased. So it became a never-ending. As my career had to decrease, as my mother's needs increased, I was trying to stay on top of the mortgage, missed payments, tried to get refinancing. Then my mortgage was transferred to many different people. So it went from New Century, they went bankrupt in 2008. So then it went to Countrywide, then Countrywide went to Bank of America.
The selling of mortgages from one institution to another can be confusing for borrowers trying to communicate with their lender. It also means that the mortgage holder doesn't know much about the terms of the loan or the individual borrower.
And Bank of America finally sent it to the servicer, Select Portfolio Servicing, which are now in a major class action lawsuit. They just never processed anything. Like, you would send them information for a modification and you'd send it repeatedly. We never got it.
As Sullivan struggled with the mortgage servicer, her mother's health declined.
And then my mother really became ill and was put on hospice. And last January, a year ago, I went to them and I said, look, I need help because she's going to die. I'm trying to balance her life and my own. Can we do a modification? And they came back and said, no, we can't do a modification.
But in March of 2017, Sullivan received news she had been approved for a loan modification.
So I called them and I said, what are you talking about? I got approved. You just told me in January I couldn't have a modification. I didn't sign any forms. Don't worry about it. We took your application from 2 years ago. And I said, well, how could you do that when my whole financials aren't the same? So we need to do a current one because this isn't going to work. I didn't hear from them.
Sullivan got a letter in May of 2017 informing her that her foreclosure auction would be June 27th.
I called them hysterical. What do you mean? We're going to modify this loan, I thought. And it was like talking to brick walls. It's like you communicate to them and they had no idea of the last communication you had with them.
I asked a few experts in the field if this type of frustration is normal. David Gasser is the director of the NeighborWorks Homeownership Center of Central Massachusetts, an organization that offers housing counseling to struggling homeowners.
Communication is always a big challenge for even us here who are professionals who understand the process, have done this many times before. Mortgage companies are not always great. It's talking to any kind of bureaucracy or large corporation. It's really difficult to get good information from them, timely information. You know, sometimes you'll call the mortgage company, speak to one person, they tell you one thing, you call back again, somebody else tells you something. And a lot of times, if they have a scheduled sale date, they don't find out until about a month before. And some mortgage companies won't even entertain a loan modification review unless it's 37 days out from the auction date, which they would never even have known there's an auction date 37 days before.
Bruce Bogoslav is the executive director of HSI Trust Home Savers, a nonprofit consumer advocacy organization. Formerly a management consultant, he's used his knowledge of the finance industry to negotiate loan modifications on behalf of hundreds of clients. He says the system is built to wear down borrowers.
Something that I've been hearing from people a lot is that even if they wanted to negotiate, they're having trouble even breaking in.
Exactly. That's the biggest hurdle. The whole thing is designed to test you. In the worst days, and it's only improved slightly, the folks who would be answering on the front line, you would find out that the most senior person in the group has been there 6 months, okay? You'd have some certain people that were literally on the phones 2 hours after they just went through a two-day training class where they were supposed to absorb everything there is to know about every type of mortgage. There's no way. There's no way anybody could do that. So what it results in for most people is a very, very frustrating experience.
Bogoslav says there's a difference between the contacts he has at banks and the helplines homeowners are directed to.
We are not dealing with the same organizations and the same people that an individual customer would be. They're going to be dealing with someone whose job and measurement usually is to get them off the phone or to get them to pay as quickly as possible. We're dealing with folks whose measurement is retention and to work with them.
Not all banks follow those practices. Karen Duffy is the president of Worcester Credit Union, where she has worked for 25 years. Whereas a traditional bank is made up of customers, credit unions are member-owned financial cooperatives. Duffy says that in her view, lenders have a responsibility to work with borrowers.
We pride ourselves on being members of the community, good corporate citizens, if you will. So we look at it as a very personal interaction with our members. We keep open communications. My collections team are made up of very caring and considerate people. If a member has an issue, all they're trying to do is keep that communications line open, bring them in for counseling, try to help them resolve whatever issue is happening. Any responsible lender should feel that responsibility of, let's work together. Let's try to figure this out, because it's in no one's interest for the loan to go bad.
Duffy says that Worcester Credit Union has actually served as an intermediary for members struggling to communicate with other lenders about their mortgages.
We've actually been in the situation on a number of times where we have been helping people who are facing foreclosure from multinational or from national mortgage companies, banks. Think of what it is for someone who is facing the loss of their home. And they can't get a real person on the phone, and they can't come in to meet somebody. And they're asked for literally reams of documents to be faxed or emailed, only to find out, well, we didn't get it. Send it again. We've intervened in those cases many times and helped people resolve, either through refinancing with us or helping them to resolve with their original lender.
Sullivan didn't have anyone to negotiate on her behalf, and her bank went forward with the sale of her house. But she says the auction, which was officially recorded as taking place at her home on June 27th, 2017, never happened.
June 27th, I was at home with my mother. I had transformed my living room, which it's facing the front of my home, into a hospital environment. I had a hospice person there. I had another PCA with me, and there was no auction on my front lawn. And I've been to auctions, and I know what they look like and sound like. There was nothing that transpired on my lawn that day. Then I got a letter a few days later saying that the bank bought my house from the bank. 2 weeks later, my mother died in the home, and that's pretty much the story.
A week after the alleged auction, Sullivan was contacted by the Worcester anti-foreclosure team. WAFT has helped Sullivan navigate fighting her foreclosure in court. Because her mortgage was bought and sold so many times, Her current bank's legal team didn't know about the predatory terms of the loan, her class action settlement, nor the falsification of her loan modification, all of which occurred under different banks. Most WAFT members involved in fighting their foreclosures represent themselves in court. I spoke with Dan Balls, a housing attorney from Springfield Community Legal Aid.
In Massachusetts, what exactly is people's right in terms of legal representation when it comes to these types of housing cases?
There is not one. There's not a right at all, not in housing cases. The vast majority of litigants in housing court, particularly on the tenant or occupant side, are unrepresented.
Self-represented litigants are supposed to be treated in the same way as professional lawyers. Sullivan shared her experience representing herself in Worcester Housing Court.
What is it like to represent yourself in court?
Oh, boy, is that scary. Let me tell you. I've done public speaking and I've been in front of large audiences. But when you're in front of a judge with someone who's gone to law school, it's very intimidating and it's very scary. And when you know that she's automatically leaning towards him because she thinks his years of education is the absolute truth, this attorney's only been involved in this whole situation since November. He hasn't lived this. So how can she make a decision based on people who don't know my story? It's only because he has a law degree and I don't. It was frightening because I was fighting for the most important, the biggest purchase I've ever made in my life, in the place where I call home for the last 20 years. I was fighting for that.
Court is where Sullivan and other individuals fighting their foreclosures hope to get their evidence against the banks heard. But many feel that their cases are not being adequately examined. One reason for this is the complexity of foreclosure law. Springfield attorney Dan Balls.
Even an attorney who has volunteered to do housing cases for a long time may not know where to start with a foreclosure case, because foreclosure is a very formal, archaic bit of law.
Again, former federal litigator Sarah McKee.
One, it's really complicated. Most lawyers, as soon as you say Uniform Commercial Code, their eyes glaze over. Another area of the law that is relevant is securitization law. That's a different area of the law. Bankruptcy law comes into this. Tax law comes into it. Nobody knows all the relevant law.
McKee says that a combination of ignorance of the law and discrimination against self-represented homeowners leads to banks not being held accountable in housing court.
So here you are, a homeowner fighting an illegal foreclosure, and you are in housing court fighting it in the context of that the plaintiff does not have standing to evict you because the plaintiff did not own the mortgage, did not hold the note, and you're dealing with judges who don't understand what standing is, which I have to tell you is shocking, and you're up against a real bias against pro se defendants. The courts don't want to listen to you. They don't want to take you seriously. It's very unclear whether some of the judges even read your pleadings. The palpable bias of the courts. When I tell lawyers who don't practice in this area what we see, they are aghast.
Attorney David Silverman is a self-described hired hitter for banks. He represents lenders in foreclosure cases and disagrees with the allegations of bias.
Look, a lot of those people that are dissatisfied, they just think it's wrong that they have to pay their mortgage, and if they don't, they lose their home. If you can't afford it, I'm sorry, but you can't own it. Personal responsibility has to mean something. America isn't a place where everyone should own a home and no one should ever be made to be responsible for their own actions. For one reason or another, they think, oh, housing court judges don't like the little people. It boggles my mind how stupid that sounds. The judges in Worcester are more than capable of understanding the most complex foreclosure fact patterns.
Micheline Oliveira has been representing herself in Worcester Housing Court. She says that she's not asking for a ruling in her favor, but rather a fair examination of the facts.
I will be happy if we have a judge say, this situation is really complicated, so I'm gonna look case by case. I'm not gonna rule anything until I understand case by case. When I say fair, it's not me. The bank is wrong. I'm not saying that. I expect to go to court and have someone look into my documents. And if you don't understand, go do some research. Ask another judge who understands or try to understand about foreclosure before I make a decision.
Oliveira is one of 18 pro se or self-represented plaintiffs in a lawsuit filed by members of WAFT against Worcester Housing Court. In January, the ACLU of Massachusetts filed a brief in support, which alleges discrimination on the basis of self-represented status, disability, and indigency. In Oliveira's case, she requested a fee waiver on the basis that she did not have sufficient income to pay to access records of her hearings. Her indigency request, like several other plaintiffs, was denied. Grace Ross explains how the cards are stacked against pro se litigants.
If you choose to represent yourself, you then are your own lawyer, and they're supposed to treat you like every other lawyer, which can be hard for folks because the expectations are pretty high. On the other hand, it turns out our judges don't think that somebody who's not a lawyer has a right to talk to them about legal questions. You can't win. You've got very wealthy lawyers who are part of an industry that's been making its money illegally. They come to relatively lower courts that are small courts, like a housing court, showing up in their fancy suits, and they're up against folks who are every walk of life under the sun, but who are all pro se. It's really easy to see how that would add up to unfair circumstances.
Few home buyers go into a mortgage anticipating they'll end up battling for their house in court. When something goes wrong, homeowners often face difficulty communicating with their mortgage holder. Massachusetts is a non-judicial state. This means that even if a homeowner believes that their foreclosure is invalid, they can't do much about it until after the auction has taken place. Once they do have the opportunity to go to court, many report an uphill battle. Experts in the field and homeowners alike say that changes need to be made at all levels of the process. Several community organizations offer financial education for first-time home buyers. The Home Ownership Center is one of those organizations. Director David Gasser.
People who take a first-time homebuyer course or undergo first-time homebuyer one-on-one counseling are far less likely to default on their mortgage. And those that do are more likely to recover from that default.
A 2013 study by NeighborWorks America found that borrowers who received pre-purchase counseling were one-third less likely to become significantly delinquent on their mortgage payments. Miranda and Carrie Suda advise other new homeowners to do their research first. Miranda Suda.
When I first bought my house, I was excited. Oh my God, I'm getting a house. And you know, all they do when you go to buy a house, you have the bank lawyers, you have the broker, and all you do is just sign papers. Oh, just put your signature there. But you're in your glory because, you know, you're going to have your own house.
Worcester Credit Union's Karen Duffy recommends another prerequisite, becoming financially literate about the home buying process.
So we want to make sure people understand all their financial products and services because it's complicated. It's not like it used to be. Mortgages themselves are very complicated. So for instance, a couple of weeks ago, we had a first-time home buyers session here. What we're trying to do is educate people. Here's how it works. Here's what you need to do to protect yourself. Because sometimes even the applicant themselves is very excited. They're looking to buy a home. That's a very exciting thing. But it has to make sense for you financially.
Duffy also points out that lending institutions need to be responsible in the loans they give.
We want to be responsible by helping them understand what makes sense for their budget and their lifestyle. It doesn't do anyone any good to tell people there's no down payment required. So we can get you this much bigger house than you thought you could get, and well, the payments will be lower for a short period of time. I think the lessons to be learned are for all of us is that we need to educate ourselves. There is personal responsibility involved. So we need to educate ourselves and we need to work with organizations, institutions, lenders who are willing to help us with that.
Bruce Bogoslav says that a switch away from local lending has reduced accountability within the industry.
Banks are not evil, but the problem is in the mortgage industry, we have shifted from 80-90% local lending, and they had skin in the game. So they would have to look their depositors in the eye, which meant they would work with you. To a scenario that's flipped to 90%, that the originator has no skin in the game whatsoever, and the loan is being passed all over the place, such that the servicer is the only party interested, and they're only interested in their servicing fees, which they get paid regardless. There's a complete disconnection between the lending and the payments. Mortgages used to require that whoever wrote it, their commission was spread over a period of time and was tied to the value of the mortgage. Meaning, if they gave out a mortgage that was awful and it blew up, they only got a portion. If it succeeded, they got paid over a period of time, which led towards sane and rational lending. And we've lost track of that. So linking it back to where writing a mortgage actually requires and is paid in a way that heads towards responsible lending, biggest policy change.
As members of Congress advance bipartisan legislation that would loosen federal oversight on banks, anti-foreclosure activists say that judges and the court system need to hold lenders and their legal teams accountable when they break the rules. Again, Sarah McKee.
It's next to useless to try to get a lawyer and go to court to try to stop a foreclosure. The courts have been very reluctant to rule for homeowners. And remember back to all of these behind-the-scenes scurryings around with assignments of mortgage and endorsements of the note or not. A homeowner, well, one, who knows this stuff? You now know more than most people in this Commonwealth. And if you don't think that's a scary thought. So here's your home. You raised your children here, you inherited it from your parents, whatever. It's your biggest investment in your life, and you don't know what's bearing down on you.
The Massachusetts Alliance Against Predatory Lending, as well as other groups, are pushing legislation that would create a separate court for foreclosure cases. In these courts, they say foreclosure cases could be heard more thoroughly by judges with specialized knowledge. Grace Ross.
It's a statewide court. The judges would ride circuit like the housing courts do, where they go around the whole county. And it's only a few judges across the state. The specialty courts that get set up tend to attract the judges who care about that. And there are several judges who've really drilled down on this. So if we could get them, it would be a game changer. And hopefully, if it was successful, it would open the door to the idea that we really should be a judicial foreclosure state.
If Massachusetts became a judicial foreclosure state, homeowners could make their case before their foreclosure is finalized. Nancy Sullivan.
We want our homes back, but we don't want our homes back so we can live scot-free. We want our homes back so we can take care of them, so we can pay for them, so we can invest in them. But like I said, life happens and emergencies happen. And because something major comes up in your life, you're supposed to lose everything in your life?
Activist Grace Ross sums it up like this.
This was the first generation of widespread ability to potentially own a home among people of color, immigrants, women heads of household. The industry figured out pretty fast how to take that money away, because redlining, they only stopped your ability to collect wealth in a certain way, the most common way, through a home. Now they figured out how to take that and everything else. Before this crisis happened, I think if you'd asked us why did the Constitution say life, liberty, and property, I think that we would have said, I don't know why property's in there. When you understand what it means to lose everything, it suddenly makes an awful lot of sense why those were on an equal footing.
We reached out to several of the banks mentioned in this story. Deutsche Bank and Bank of America did not return our request for comment. Micheline Oliveira was evicted from her house and has been staying with family. She told us her children refused to pass by their former home. After successfully postponing her eviction in March, Nancy Sullivan was evicted this month. She has moved in with her ex-husband. Miranda and Carrie Suda are still waiting to appear in court.
Co-wrote co-written and co-produced by Hallie Blashfield and myself, Beatrice Mischer. Editorial oversight for Foreclosures for Sale provided by Ronald Schachter. Music by Nick Raymond. Special thanks to Ramon Borges Mendez, Melissa Marsland, Jim Blashfield, Keith Snodgrass, Linda Mischer, Troy Tyree at WCUW, and to all the people who lent their time and stories to help us understand this complicated subject.